Welcome back to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have Taylor Young on the show. Taylor, how are you doing?
I'm good. Very happy to be here.
Thank you for coming on the show. Of course, you are an editor for Antelope Hill Publishing. Is that your position there?
So I used to be an editor. I've since moved on to some of the more public outreach stuff that we do. But I did used to be an editor. I didn't work on this particular book, but I just do whatever's required, basically. So for those who aren't familiar, we are an independent dissident publishing company. We focus on works that are related to, generally speaking, the history of the European people, whether in Europe or the United States. The company started with the intention of republishing books that were difficult to access for the modern reader or not available in English. Our very first, not quite our very first book, but our very first project, not the first book that we published, was The Burning Souls by Leon Degrelle, which basically the company started in part because the partners wanted to read that book and it wasn't available in English. So we did the first translation of it ourselves, and we eventually published that. We published other historical books, other historical accounts from the 20th century and other periods from Germany, Britain, Spain, quite a few, Ireland, and so on. And since then, we've also done original fiction. We've done other original books by new authors, such as The Transgender Industrial Complex and other books by Scott Howard. And we have published The American Regime, which is a work by a anonymous January 6th prisoner. And and much, much more. We have Lord Miles, we have Rogue Nationalists. So we've really branched out a lot in that. But you can find it all at antelopehillpublishing.com. So I won't drag that on, but that's the plug.
Well, tonight we're here to discuss When Israel is King. It's the book focuses on the events that took place in Hungary in the early part of the 20th century, right after released right near the end of the First World War, 1918, 1919, thereabouts. And it kind of details how the communists and Jews, Bela Kun and company, were able to kind of intrigue their way in their power, taking advantage of the turmoil and disruptions of that war, the disintegration of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and the independence of Hungary, which immediately led to its almost disintegration because other surrounding powers invaded and took a bunch of territory. And this led to this installation of a communist regime. I think of the 48 Commissars, 30 were Jewish, I think. That's about more than, and it was largely a Jewish regime. And this was, I think, the second at the time, the first, of course, being the Soviet Union and Lenin's regime that had come to power in 1917 through 1921. This book, When Israel is King, I'll let you take it from there.
Yeah, so that's a good introduction of it. So it basically covers the period of Hungarian history from the end of World War I through the end of the Hungarian Soviet Republic, which existed for only about 4 months, and that was led by Bela Kun. Now, it does start by looking back a bit further through Hungarian history, and it's very interesting because this Hungarian Soviet Republic and the communist takeover of Hungary is kind of like the climax of the story. And it is kind of, it's told like a story, obviously, even though it's talking about historical events and it's talking about history, it's told as though you're being told a story by someone who's partly an eyewitness. So, but it's really, it's more than a story of the Hungarian communism. It's a story really of the Jewish people and Hungary. And it starts with talking about how the Jews started settling in Hungary. They were welcomed at first, generally speaking, just out of the generous nature of the Hungarian people. And it was around the time that the Hungarian aristocracy and the old kind of feudal system was fading away, was coming to an end, and the Jews were able to position themselves in various places in the new city of Pest, across the river from Buda, which forms Budapest, the capital, where they became the financial class and the merchant class. There were also Germans there who had previously been a lot of the merchant class in that city. And then in the country, they would, the Jews, you know, the ones that didn't form kind of their the Jewish communities that you would think of, like the rural Jewish communities. They basically managed to take advantage of the decline of the Hungarian aristocracy and position themselves to be caretakers of estates, and they eventually take over estates, and eventually put a lot of the old Hungarian nobility into debt to them, from which they continued to accumulate power and influence and continue to help bring in more Jews and settle more Jews in Hungary. So that is kind of the state of affairs for a long time. And the sense the book gives you is that the Jews are, in a sense, they're kind of like biding their time. They're waiting for something across generations. They want you know, part of the answer you could find in the whole heal the world and their whole vision of a, you know, a kind of bringing the Messiah and the their idea of a messianic future down to earth. So they're waiting for something, and then it basically, their opportunity begins to arrive with the upheavals in politics in Hungary near the end of World War One, where you have Count Tisza, who, and we can go into more detail on these characters individually, but basically he becomes unpopular as a result of the end of the war. He's overthrown by another nobleman, Karoly, who is of a much more opportunistic and baser character, and is basically just in it for himself, and he begins accumulating revolutionary Jews around him, who end up using him and his movement to then get themselves into power, and then ultimately Jewish power is culminated in Bela Kun and the Hungarian Soviet Republic. And then when that falls, there's a lot of anger against the Jews. So it's a short book, but it tells a long story. And it tells, you know, a story that I think we recognize is often repeated. And I think in that it's very interesting in how it shows kind of some of the perennial dynamics between Jew and Gentile and how they play themselves out.
One thing I found interesting was Bela Kun, how he came to power was he positioned himself as sort of a nationalist willing to defend Hungary from being invaded. What had happened was Hungary had separated itself from the Habsburg Empire, the signal the end of the dual monarchy, and they struck a separate peace with the Allies, Triple Entente. And I think one of the conditions that Wilson had put on Hungary was total demilitarization and demobilization. So Hungary was left vulnerable, at least defenseless. And then along came, I think, Romania, and then the newly formed Czechoslovakia invaded. And so then he was able to use that as a rallying cry to get support, and that I think it's when Karoly resigned and Bela Kun was installed. He wasn't the official leader of the state, but he was effectively there because he had ties to Lenin and the Bolsheviks, who had funded him. I think they'd given him a lot of money to you know, agitate in Hungary, finance his magazine. He actually, I think, from the within 24 hours, he went from jail to being in power, if I recall right.
Yeah. He was the de facto leader. He basically chose to put another person as a figurehead. I think the book actually notes that it was one of the very few Christian Gentiles that was part of the Hungarian Soviet movement, who was kind of selected as a figurehead to make it slightly less Jewish. Although, as you noted earlier, I think it was something like out of the 23 commissars, 18 were Jewish, but you know, the same imbalance could be seen pretty much everywhere where you looked in that regime.
Go ahead.
I was just going to go back to the nationalism thing you mentioned because it is interesting, and again, there's some different ways in which that comes into play throughout the story. So the one of the senses that the book gives you is that there's the Gentiles, generally speaking, both good and bad, both the heroes and the villains, are ultimately kind of naive about what they're doing. And the Hungarians, when they declare their independence from the Austro-Hungarian Empire, they don't really factor in the idea that, you know, they themselves are a multi-ethnic state or multi-ethnic country, and they kind of don't, you know, expect it all to hold together, and then find that quickly that Károly finds that this new state that that has declared independence is now becoming prey to the very same forces that it had used to declare its independence. So, you know, if Hungary can be independent, then you know, why not the Serbs and the Croats and you know, all the Yugoslavs and all these other groups that are part of Hungary? Why shouldn't they also now become independent from Hungary? So that started happening, and then, as you noted, you had foreign armies that began invading Hungary because it had demilitarized. So, you know, by that point, by the time that the Soviets had took over, they basically did have to kind of appeal to nationalism in this reactionary sense, just to try to get things under control and be able to claim that they were offering Hungary something.
And of course, once in power, Belakun's regime installs, you know, typical communistic policies. Instead of land reform, I think he tries to collectivize the farms, which alienates, you know, the peasantry, the people in the countryside. He seizes bank accounts and closes shops, nationalizes things. Of course, then the economy collapses. Imposes price controls and things like that. So then there's of course, a crisis in the economy, and then of course, then there's a I think in the summer of 1919, there's an attempted coup, which then gives a pretext or a reaction of a red terror. This was called Lenin's Boys or something. That's sort of I guess Hungarian version of the Cheka counter-revolution force, and they institute a red terror for a few months, which just further alienates the government from the people.
Yeah, absolutely. So the basically, as is often the case, again, the source of the power of this movement was the urban working class and also just urban Jews, primarily in Budapest, rather than, you know, the most of Hungary, which was rural and which was just small villages and farmers and so on. So yeah, so again, the Soviet Republic is very short-lived. It's only about 4 months, and like you were saying, in those 4 months, they try basically, you know, everything they can think of, and all ends up going disastrously. They have Lenin's boys. They have you know, people who hunt down dissidents, or just, you know, hunt down people because they need rob them to fund the state. They try confiscating wealth. They try printing their own money, but they don't have you know, like an actual printer for money, so they have to use like cheaper white paper money, and then they try to make the old money illegal to get some of that back so that the state can have some more money itself. You know, all their attempts at like reorganizing land or reorganizing the economy end up just creating a class of beneficiaries by virtue of their friendship with the party, and then, you know, everyone else suffers. There's price controls, which just like quickly leads to the depletion of available goods. You know, there's controls over the universities and so on. So it all just really goes downhill pretty quickly, and they kind of admit it, but they don't really know what to do about it.
Belakun, I think real name was Cohen, or original name was Cohen. He had been, I think, was he in the Ukraine or Crimea during the Russian Revolution? I think he had been a soldier. He'd been conscripted and then captured, and then joined the Bolsheviks after the revolution in Russia. and Lenin put him in charge. Was it the Crimea or Ukraine? I forget. I think it might have been Ukraine. He'd been an executioner there, so he had piled up a large body count in Russia before going back to Hungary.
Yeah, no, he ended up in Russia, like you said, as he was captured and he was taken to Siberia. And while there, he became a Bolshevik. After the Bolsheviks came to power, he managed to ingratiate himself with them, and they kept basically giving him money for various subversive projects, newspapers, trying to organize I think like a prisoners brigade, which didn't go very far. And then basically, he ended up in Hungary with a significant subsidy from the Soviets to do his agitating.
And once in power, he also, instead of trying to, I guess, stabilize the situation in Hungary, he started, I guess, using scarce resources on promoting revolution abroad, like in Austria and Germany, right?
Yeah, I mean, again, they just basically, it's funny. It's like, every one of these little, or however large these communist rebellions are, they all kind of act the same. It's like now Hungary is going to become the new base of international Bolshevism and international revolution, which I think another angle to that is, it goes to show both the some of the Jewish origins of Bolshevism and what attracted Jews to Bolshevism, the idea of this international, cross-border, worldwide, leveling of barriers and of the old hierarchies. So again, it's another reason why the revolution was so Jewish, and you can see in the book how Jews really placed their faith, even before the Hungarian Revolution. They had already been looking to the Soviet Union and anticipating this great like sweep of communist revolutions across Europe. So, when that happened in Hungary, they thought that their day had come.
Yeah, as in the Soviet Union and Russia and Hungary, the Red Terror was mostly a Jewish thing.
Oh yes,
Yeah,
absolutely. I
yeah.
mean, again, we've touched on like how great the overrepresentation of Jews, in the Hungarian Soviet Republic was, and in their terror structure, and it's noted in the book. Whenever there's a lot of the characters that pop up that are responsible for this are Jewish. And again, you can see it earlier in the story as well. Like, when you have the before the communist revolution in Hungary, the previous revolution that led to the independence of Hungary was already beginning to accumulate Jews of various stripes, including socialists, who basically were attracted to it as a revolutionary force simply because they wanted to overthrow the old order.
Yeah, it's almost it's similar to what occurred in Russia with the provisional government Kerensky, and then just at
Yeah.
the right time, the Bolsheviks were able to seize power, and then of course enjoying subsidies from abroad as well from the West, ironically, I guess, or super, at least at the superficial level, it seems ironic, but there were designs on Russia from the Western bankers and particularly Jacob Schiff and company, and those who had sort of a ancestral hatred of Russia. From what they experienced, or what they thought they experienced, or what they claimed to experience in Russia with their ancestors, like in the Pale of the Settlement. These were the Jews that had migrated west in the late 19th century, and a few of them had done very well in the West, Germany, and also the United States. And they turned around and waged ethnic warfare on Russia. That's sort of the hidden grammar of the Russian Revolution. Bolsheviks, there's nothing naturally Russian about the Bolsheviks.
Yeah, no, absolutely,
Yeah.
absolutely. And again, the book gives its own short version of Hungarian history. It's possible that there was more animosity toward the Jews than it goes into detail on. That's not really what it's focused on, but in its focus, it does discuss how, again, the Jews are initially welcomed into Hungary, and they're largely received generously by the Hungarians, and yet nevertheless they still have the same amount of animosity, and ultimately it comes down not just to, you know, whatever is the relationship between the Jews and whatever host Gentile population they live under, but it's also influenced just by the Jewish character itself and by their, you know, by their supremacist character and their view of themselves in relation to all Gentiles and in relation to, you know, what they want from Gentiles, how they believe that they should interact with Gentiles and so on.
Yeah, they presume a sort of an exploitative relationship, and there's no inhibition on that you get from a Christian society about cheating and lying, where there it's presumed that you do that to Gentiles. That's, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's like just a lack of a moral standard. I think it's actually it's kind of funny because I think that I've been on your show once before to talk about you Gentiles.
Mm-hmm.
I hope I'm not misremembering, but I kept remembering You Gentiles, which is a book that we've published, or we've republished that one. I kept remembering You Gentiles when I was reading this book because
yeah.
Again of like how well it illustrates some of the perennial dynamics that occur between Jew and Gentile, and how well they illustrate that the Jews, you know, no matter how they're treated or no matter what the circumstances they find themselves in, they always have and always will consider themselves a race apart, and they always will consider themselves as having this this holy mission to change the world and to basically invert the world and all of its hierarchy and order in their image.
Well, which is why it's a difficult thing in terms of, like, particularly since the 19th century, idea of citizenship, whereas before the 19th century, it was just presumed that Jews in Europe and, you know, Christian Europe could not be citizens because they weren't Christian. This was when, you know, these were Christian societies, formerly confessional states. And so if you simply weren't Christian, you simply could be a full citizen because you were, a people apart. And with the 19th century came the idea of citizenship and secularization, but it still didn't successfully integrate the Jews. The Jews demanded both citizenship and to be treated separately and have a privileged status. And also seeing themselves not as you know, purely Hungarian or French or German, they were Jews. And they were a people who shall dwell alone, as they say. And this complicates things because that's how they identify. They identify not so much as Americans or French, you know, or Germans. They're Jews first. And that, of course, that's instantiated or represented mostly in the creation of the Israeli state in 1948 and Zionism, which pretty much admits that, creates that complication, because if all Jews are first and foremost citizens of Israel, and this also includes the diaspora, it brings into question their loyalty, of course. And of course, the current events now, and how, if you look at polling and all that, Jews identify strong, even America throughout Europe, Jews identify strongly with Israel. In fact, they identify first with Israel. If you look at the polling data, well, that does create a problem with dual loyalty, especially if the Jews are entrusted with a certain amount of political, cultural, and economic power in your society, and they start to bend your society to their particular interest, their narrow interest, at the expense of the society at large, which creates animosity and hatred, which then they always spin as sort of irrational anti-Semitism. But as you look in this book, there's a context. to these events, like, you good example. Well, we can talk about this, is the fall of the Belakun regime after 4 months is largely because the country is being invaded. The Red Army from Russia never comes to help Hungary. Belakun came to power promising he'd bring in the Red Army. You know, looking back now, it's not, you know, naive. The Hungarians are to expect help from the Red Army, but I think the Red Army got caught up in Poland or something. So they simply, Lenin's regime was very fragile at that point. And so they couldn't intervene on behalf of Belakun. So his regime collapsed because he was unable to deliver on his primary campaign promise, which was preserve Hungarian integrity. So he hightailed it out of there, and his regime collapsed. Then you had, it was Admiral Horthy who installed his regime. And he, of course, the reaction after 4 months, a mere 4 months, is this white terror reaction to the come. And there's sort of these, you know, they call them pogroms, I guess, but reaction to Jews. And some of that is provided in the book, stories where this one Jew was chased out of a bar, and the Jew manifested a baptism certificate claiming to be a Catholic. I guess they're Catholic in Hungary. And they said, "Oh, if that's so, recite the Our Father." He could only say the first sentence. So I guess he was lynched. But this, if you don't put that reaction in context, like of the past 4 months, it seems like Hungarians are just these rabid anti-Semites. No, they're reacting to something. And Abner Horthy's regime was a reaction to red terror. White terror is a reaction to red terror.
Yeah, and that's always how it goes. It's just like you're saying, after everything that the Hungarians had seen from this, what had become by that point just an overtly Jewish regime, it's small wonder that they would react with such anger. I think the very end of the book after that, it kind of talks about how, this is not ultimately a conflict that's finished. This is a dialogue without end, and the Jews were put down. Their rebellion was put down in Hungary. The reign of Israel, at least in for that time, was ended in Hungary, but it's not over, and it's on the Gentile peoples to learn their lesson to avoid continuing to repeat the same mistakes and create the same scenarios.
Rather prescient, because this was early on in the 20th century, which has been called the Jewish century. And of course, the Second World War is yet to occur. The Holocaust narrative has yet to be sort of concretized in the consciousness of the West. So a lot of people are, at this time, are willing to express their feelings about Jews, identify the, sort of the ethnic dimension to this. That they'll call out the Jew, and it's a, in Hungary and many other places, it was kind of considered normal or just an acknowledgement of a fact. I mean, this is the era when Hilaire Belloc, the Catholic writer, is writing a book called The Jews, and he writes about this problem, Hilaire Belloc. Even Winston Churchill was talking about, the Jews, will it be Zionism or communism? That was the thing. So it was sort of a broad acknowledgement of this problem, of the Jewish question, if you will, throughout the West. And that question again became forbidden to ask after the Second World War because of the Holocaust narrative and the events in Europe, particularly the defeat of National Socialist Germany and the narrative that came out of that. So anyone criticizing Jewish power or pointing out in disproportion or inordinate Jewish power in your society and the damage it does is equated to the Nazis. So it's forbidden, effectively,
Yeah, no, that is the situation which we find ourselves now. Again, is one reason why it's good to have books like this that remind you of what the history actually is and what it probably will be again.
Yeah, the book ends with a sort of a dialogue between a Christian and a Jew, right? At the end, and they both spell out their positions, and you see the differences, but it's eternal struggle. The Christian mindset, the European Occidental Christian mindset, and the Jewish mindset, and there's incompatibility there, which the liberal order claims to resolve, and it doesn't. All it does is create a situation where ethnic whites. Ethnic Europeans are deprived an identity, and Jews only ones are allowed to have one. Like the only one allowed to have an ethnic state are Jews. Every other ethnic group, particularly white ethnic groups, are considered racist if they have such aspirations or feelings about their country.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like you were saying earlier, the transition to citizenship, perhaps, it certainly did its part to help integrate the Jews. They got over that first hump of being clearly designated and seen as outsiders and seen as outside society. And now, now we're supposedly all together where we have to try to form one society. But as soon as you get there, you realize that that's not really what it's all about. Or it's not enough. It's all just a stepping stone. And, they continue to keep themselves different while grinding us down and destroying our own identity.
Well, I think in Hungary, after the fall of Béla-Kun, there were explicit limitations put on Jews, right? Which are now considered, retrograde and racist and anti-Semitic. But these were weren't that much different than, say, the restrictions that existed prior to the French Revolution and the Napoleonic era. meaning there were national restrictions put on Jewish citizenship or denied to them, meaning the idea that your society had to, the government had to protect society from the influence of Jews. And, you know, I think the Catholic Church's position on this was sicut judaeus non, which is no one has the right to molest the Jew, bother the Jew, but the Jew has no right to corrupt the culture. And so that was the understanding, meaning that there is an acknowledgement that there is something different about them. And they themselves celebrate their differences and are constantly talking about their differences. And they have their own organizations, intelligence apparatus, and, you know, groups that advocate narrowly for their interests at the expense of everyone else. But at the same time, they want to pose as citizens and not be subjected to any scrutiny or suspicion, even though their very activism naturally invites that suspicion, you know, at least it should, you know.
Yeah, and they're also openly proud of their revolutionary character as well. That is something that they also openly celebrate. But again, if you point that out, or if you just repeat what they are saying about themselves, then now you're an anti-Semite.
One thing I found interesting was that happened during the Bela Kun regime, a mere 4 months in power. You think after getting the power, given all the problems, just the practical administration of the state and government dealing with the post-war, adjusting to the peace, all the disruptions from the war, you think they you know, get involved. They focus on the mundane operations of government to get commerce, to get, you know, things rolling again, to get, you know, get the farms operating, get people fed. No, they immediately embark on this revolutionary crusade abroad and at home, you know, disrupting society, causing starvation, you know, suffering, impoverishment, just to satisfy this revolutionary urge they have. It's ideology to spread the revolution. And saying anything, doing anything to get in the power, than doing the exact opposite, is that I think the culture minister for Bela Kun was this guy, Gregor Lukacs, who immediately instituted a sexual education regime within the schools. He also, I think he canceled religious education and started instituting a sexual education program similar to the stuff like that we're seeing today in public schools, which is largely done like the ADL. Good example, ADL has a curriculum that promotes LGBTQ and transgender rights, and they sell it to public school systems to institute it in their curriculum. The Anti-Defamation League does this all under the guise of protecting minority rights, of course. But the same agenda is being carried out by Gregor Lukacs in a mere 4 months. And he's teaching kids all types of sexual perversions. And this is a pattern we see all throughout. Anywhere where Jews come into power, they start promoting these things. Good example in Weimar Germany, and with Jews also were able to enjoy a disproportionate cultural influence, owning all the cinemas, the cabarets, and these things. And they were promoting this. Of course, the infamous Magnus Hirschfeld, and he was the pioneer in sex, you know, gender reassignment surgery, basically mutilating people, promoting all types of sexual perversion and these things. And this is something you see in any country, and it's again one of these disturbing patterns you see, and we see it today. And you published a book, Transgender Industrial Complex, where Scott Howard provides a list of all the foundations that are involved and all the organizations and all the families involved in promoting this degenerate perversion. And they're almost all Jewish, you know.
Yeah. It's just like you're saying, like, as soon as they got into power, they just embarked on this frenzy of revolutionary activity, to the complete detriment of being able to functionally run a state. And the cultural revolution part, that was a big part of it, as was the whole Red Terror and just the general attempt to completely destroy the wealthy and the middle class. So it's basically, you know, whenever they come into any power, they generally try to use it to the utmost extent, which in some cases kind of proves to be their undoing, because they try to go too far too fast. Sometimes you almost have to be more worried about the Jews who realize it might be more beneficial to boil the frogs more slowly.
Yeah, the chutzpah, they don't know any limitations, and it gets them in trouble. I think we might be saying, but I think the transgender nonsense is an example of that. It's just too much.
Yeah, I
Some
mean,
people,
it's amazing how quickly it happened. Just, in the U.S., for example, like it's really within such a short time period that there has been such a significant societal and cultural and ideological change that's come about around this issue, and now it's such a pervasive thing, and it's a thing that has destroyed so many lives and so many souls by this point. And it's something that would have been unthinkable less than like 10, 20 years ago.
Yeah, I think the most influential in promoting that agenda is the Jewish billionaires, of course, George Soros, Paul Singer, Jennifer Pritzker. She's out of Chicago. She bankrolled Barack Obama. What's another one? Sheldon Adelson. He's dead now. I think even the early research, like Dr. Money at Johns Hopkins back in the 1970s, he was Jewish. Chaim Sabin is another a big name there. His Sabin Fund funds the Research Institute for Children's Hospital of Los Angeles, which engages in research and transgender surgery, sexual reassignment surgery for minors, which is again, this stuff should be criminal. List of foundations: Open Society Foundation, Pritzker-Trobit Family Foundation, Walter and Elise Haas Fund, Evelyn Walter Haas Jr. Fund, Zellerbeck Family Foundation, the Clairman Family Foundation, Adelson Family Foundation, the Shaq Sackler Foundation. I mean, that's the Sackler family from the pharmaceutical company. The Matan B. Seder Foundation. All Jewish. All promoting all this LGBTQ plus stuff and all the transgender stuff. I mean, yeah, it's a pattern that you see. Again, it's just something you saw it in Germany in the 20s. Again, of course, there's a reaction there in the 1930s with the rise of Adolf Hitler. And the Nazis largely campaigning against some of these excesses that that the Germans experienced, and also the sort of the humiliation and impoverishment that they suffered at the hands of many Jews during the Weimar period. So it's something, again, a pattern we see.
And again, the opposition to communism in Germany was also a big part of that, which again was also a very, very Jewish movement, obviously. The interesting thing about that list you're reading off is it's it's completely independent of the ostensible political party of these people. Like, Adelson was a lifelong Republican. Plenty of the others were Democrats, and Paul Singer was another Republican, Jewish Republican donor. And it's like, well, when it really comes down to it, it doesn't matter. Those are just part of the smoke screen and the show to keep the Gentiles occupied, but really they're all ultimately agreed and marching together toward the same end.
Yeah, good example during the good example of this situation, at least the dilemma that we face is both major parties in the United States are controlled by Jewish donors, big donors. Right now the Biden administration is in political hot water because of Bibi Netanyahu's Israel and its ethnic cleansing operation in Gaza, which is alienating the Biden administration's left-wing support. And so Biden administration is trying to at least rhetorically criticize Israel while fu lavishly funding it, its ethnic cleansing operation, supporting it. But then all now Jewish donors are now switching their funding to Republican Party. So the Republican Party becomes even more Zionist, the more philo-Semitic, to outflank or I guess to garner support from these donors that was previously for the Biden administration. So regardless of who wins the White House in 2024, it's going to be a Zionist president,
Yeah, absolutely. And that's how they are able to maintain the level of control that they have and the level of support for Israel, even when it becomes increasingly out of step with what would be the popular will in America if it were to actually be democratically expressed.
Now, obviously, the book, you look at it, and this is history. This is 100 years ago, but it's not history because it's more relevant than ever. Would you care to reflect on, or at least talk about some of the parallels with Hungarians, what H Hungary was going through in 1919, and what the West, the United States, is experiencing today?
Well, obviously, one of the big parallels is just the Jewish interest in any kind of revolutionary activity, anything that is oriented toward overturning old established hierarchy and order and principles that create an orderly society. Anything as long as it's not anti-Semitic, of course, it's the one line that's generally the only thing that can make a political movement anywhere close to impervious to this kind of infiltration. But that's one big thing. And then besides that, I think what I kind of alluded to earlier is one of the biggest things that stood out to me through the whole story is that a lot of the Gentile characters are a lot more reactionary in their thinking, in the sense that they're not looking forward into the future on as long a timeline, they're also just kind of naive as to the Jewish character and as to their real intentions and just the fact that they are a different people and they cannot be seen the same way or reasoned with the same way because it just doesn't mean the same thing to them. So you have characters who may try to use Jews to their own ends, but it ends up working the opposite way. So I think the lesson is that we cannot be this naive toward this group, toward this people and their differences from us and their intentions and the fact that no matter what they say or how they present themselves, though that character and those intentions are never going to change.
Yeah, that's something because I talk to a lot of people who are conservative or right wing who lament or are very critical of what they see going on in their culture, whether it's in entertainment, the whole LGBTQ stuff and transgender stuff and what's going on in the schools, and they decry it and they hate it, but they can't identify who's pushing it. And they're not willing to identify the power structure, the groups that are actually endorse, promoting these, and they're not seeing it. They just see it as sort of crazy left wing stuff. They don't see it as an ethnic agenda, and sort of the hidden grammar of American history is sort of ethnic warfare, and the idea is that if you would name the organizations, and obviously the Jewish identity of those promoting these things is key to understanding why it's being promoted, because it's subversive. It's that revolutionary spirit that perdures in with Jews throughout history. Why it exists, some say it has something to do with the crucifixion of Jesus Christ and rejection of the Savior, and that set them against the Christ, the Logos, the meaning of the universe. So they're natural revolutionaries. Others say it's the Talmud, and modern Judaism is now Talmudry, and that it inevitably creates a situation where most Jews are very antagonistic and have contempt for their host societies, and it's full of justifications for all types of enormities and injustices and exploitation and terrible things that they're able to get away with because it's that's how they relate to other people, non-Jews, the Gentiles, regardless of what the source of it is. And again, it's you're talking 2,000 years of acculturization and sort of, I guess you could say, adapting survival strategies, if you will, to the point now it's almost become almost epigenetic for the Jews. And how do you separate that? Some say conversion, but it has to be sincere conversion. There's a history of false conversion. And that conversion isn't necessarily religious, it's also ideological. You kind of alluded to it, where these Jews, whether it's Singer, Adelson, Chaim Sabin, they can be left or right, but whether they're left or right, they're always promoting what they perceive to be Jewish interests. And that's the problem for our political process, because our political process thinks you join, assumes that we're citizens and our ethnic identity doesn't matter, that we're a proposition nation. As long as you believe in the American proposition, it doesn't matter what color or ethnicity you are. Well, evidently it does. And so the problem is our political language isn't designed to deal with it. Because if we do deal with it, it's considered sort of retrograde. We're going back, and we always got to be moving forward. And isn't Forward a Jewish magazine?
So, it is.
yeah. But no one ever bothered us. Where are we headed? You know, is it a good idea to move forward if there's a cliff that you're approaching? No, you have to stop and change direction. You know, we were headed in the wrong direction. And that's something that most people aren't willing to ask, you know.
Yeah, for sure. No, it's important to take stock of the situation and be able to analyze it and analyze how we got here. And I think what is necessary is a, and I think what you were alluding to earlier about how, you know, some people they notice all these problems with society, but they don't know where to place the blame, or maybe they're not comfortable placing the blame on where it belongs. And really, you know, white Gentiles especially are going to have to redevelop a sense of self-identity as well as a sense toward the future, and a, you know, not just trying to kind of like stop the bleeding or bandage the wounds, because then you'll always be on the defensive. You have to have to formulate a vision for where we want to go, so that to guide how we behave toward these people and how we behave in general. It's like, you know, it's again, well, one of the big differences that stands out between the Jews in the book and the Hungarians is that the Jews from the second that like the first Jew steps foot into Hungary, like he's looking toward this eternal vision in his mind, and all the generations of their people are working towards that, and they're all you know, every little act that they take and all their energies are devoted into bringing that about. Whereas the Hungarian Gentiles and the old aristocracy and so on, you know, a lot of them are very noble people and they're very fair people, but they kind of don't really know what to do with how much the world is changing, and they're just trying to cling to old ideas and preserve like a sense of decorum. So, you know, ultimately Europeans are very deeply generous people and a fair people, but they're also, you know, has to be a sense of justice and a sense of strength to not allow that to be taken advantage of, because, you know, it's historically it's been a way sometimes for other groups to weasel their way in and to take advantage of us. But I think that conversely, it can also be a strength and a means of defeating others. It's just that, you know, we have to basically realize that we're not joining this, you know, the new society of the future where everyone is equal and all differences are stripped away. It's actually just an assault on us, and everyone else gets to keep their identity and use it to assault us with.
Well, yeah, it's like saying it's okay to be white is considered racist. When that, I can't think of a more inoffensive expression of ethnic pride. It's okay.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, nevertheless, it's ADL. I mean, the ADL even came out and said that the traditional Latin mass was anti-Semitic. And so then they're telling people how Catholics should practice their faith. They presume, you know, imagine if Catholics actually went into a synagogue and started telling the Jews how they should, you know, worship or carry on. I mean, it's like just the chutzpah of these people. It's just astonishing,
Yeah, well,
you know.
basically it's just you know, they do that kind of stuff because unfortunately they can get away with it to a large degree. So there's nothing to stop them other until we tell them that they have to stop, basically. It's like I think this is a pitfall in a lot of like especially older like older style conservatives fall into, is that they want someone to be the adult in the room. You know, maybe it's the Constitution, or maybe it's our civic ideals or something. They want someone else to come along and like protect them and make everyone get along, but that's just not how it works. You know, the only adult in the room is, it's got to be you.
Like I can walk in to the offices of ADL and pull out a little pocket constitution and they'll behave.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it's a question of power. And the problem is power is a constant. It's a question of who's exercising it. And there is some, I think it was, what was his name? Schmidt, the legal theorist, the German legal theorist.
Carl Schmitt.
Carl Schmidt, who talked about this idea of the sovereign, sovereignty, and the liberal order presumes or at least claims that there is something called, there's instead of the sovereign, we have the constitution, rule of law. But he always talks about that. There's always the question of who decides, and that's always going to be the question. The reality is that the sovereign is the one who makes the exception, who the exception applies to. And in this situation, in the West, we've told ourselves that we don't need a sovereign. We just have the law. You can refer to the law, point your finger, and we all see how that works. Because you, especially with Talmudic lawyers, right? They're going to interpret it in a way that's most, effective, and play word games and come up with any justification, for violating the words or meaning of the Constitution. And they're not liberal. Now, the problem is liberal presumes reciprocity. The problem, if one side doesn't practice reciprocity, then you don't have a liberal order to begin with, and the game's over, and it's foolish to keep playing the game at that point. That's the situation. I think we're kind of like in a pre-revolutionary, maybe in a revolutionary time here in the West, when we see the abuse of the criminal justice system, the imposition or the effect, censorship and cancel culture being used against dissident voices, the idea, the writing of hate crimes laws and of these things that's being advocated. These exist in Europe. In the West, it's in the United States, it's different, more difficult because we have a First Amendment. But nevertheless, you have the right to say, speak your mind, but your life can be ruined. So if you speak up against certain things, or attack or criticize certain groups,
Yeah. I agree. That's what it's devolved to today, and
I just saw an Instagram thing that was sent to me where it had Jonathan Greenblatt bragging about how the ADL has agents, I call them commissars, being deployed to all the big tech companies, like Google, from Amazon to Zoom. He said that they're monitoring everything, like this conversation. And so the ADL is not a civil rights organization. It is an intelligence operation. It's a private intelligence operation working for Israel. And so therefore, it should not be allowed to operate within the United States. At very least, it should be forced to register as a foreign agent. But AIPAC isn't even forced to register as a foreign agent, even though it's the American-Israel Political Action Committee. But it's a criminal operation as well, too. It's been caught engaged in criminal activity. First, it was created to cover up for Jewish crimes.
With the Leo Frank
case, and that's been their purpose for existing. But now they're engaged in all types of subversion and suppression of free speech. And now, for Pete's sake, they got Congress to pass a bill, the House of Representatives, to try to seize TikTok because it isn't completely under Jewish control. They're claiming it's the Chinese. But the only problem is the thing is TikTok. There's a lot of criticism of Israel on TikTok. So all of a sudden, it's become a problem. It becomes a national security problem.
Yeah, and all of a sudden, you can criticize foreign influence when it's China, but not when it's Israel.
Yes, because again, that's that dual loyalty, that sort of ambiguity there. Because I think as eight or nine and 10 Jews identify strongly with Israel. Well, that's a foreign country. you don't see German Americans or German Irish Americans or Italian identifying strongly with Germany or Italy. They're American, for better or for worse, whatever that means these days. You don't get the German lobby. You don't get like the there is no like Scottish lobby getting like Americans caught spying for Russia or something like that, lobbying for their release. But you did get Jews, getting what's his name?
Pollard.
Pollard. Jonathan Pollard. you know. And then he's flown back in Sheldon Adelson's plane, an American billionaire, no, Jewish billionaire, and he's treated like a hero in Israel. So how is it that a traitor to America can be treated as a hero in Israel? Obviously, there's the interest of the two governments don't or two countries don't exactly align there, do they? I mean,
yeah, and I would even go further, and you know, it's definitely like you're saying, it's some really, really high percentage, 90, maybe even more than 90% of Jews identify with Israel. I think you could even go further and say, well, they identify with the state of Israel because it happens to exist. Mm-hmm. But if the state of Israel did not exist, you know, that specific question of do you identify with the state of Israel wouldn't be relevant, but the same dynamic would nevertheless exist, where they identify with Israel as the Jewish people, which is, you know, what it's referred to in the title of this book, When Israel is King. It's Israel refers to the Jews of Hungary, and the Jews all over the world will always identify with each other more than, you know, more than any Gentile. They just like it says in You Gentiles, they are the only true transnational and the only true cosmopolitan people. And there's, you know, even Gentile cosmopolitans are fundamentally not the same thing. It's something that is completely foreign to the Gentile experience and to our way of doing things and to what we consider to be fair and just and reasonable.
Yeah, that's why Judea was able to declare war on Germany in 1933.
Yeah, exactly. And
there,
you know,
how do they organize international boycott if they had no power? If they were, you know, a persecuted, weak, a powerless minority? How did they get the Balfour Declaration? So, you know, all these maneuvers. And by the way, the Balfour Declaration was one of the principal reasons why the war was extended, because it got the United States into the war on behalf of the Allies, the Triple Entente.
Mm-hmm.
With the promise that and how that was achieved was a promise of Lord Balfour to Rothschild. And Rothschild said that they would use Jewish influence in the United States to get the United States into the war on behalf of the Triple Entente. Because at that point, that's when they made the promise of Palestine to Israel, I mean, to Jews. Before that, most Jews actually pro-German. That chain that flipped, honest,
yeah,
flipped,
yeah. Well. So that they're, you know, they've always been able, well, wherever they've accumulated power, they've, it's always ultimately been for the same purpose of, you know, bringing about, not just a state, but their rule over other peoples.
Yeah, and so prolonged the First World War, which then created the political turmoil, instability in Central Europe. Obviously, with Germany and the collapse of the Habsburg Empire, the dual monarchy, and the successor states, and it created all these border disputes between Romania and Czechoslovakia and Poland, all went grabbing because all these borders were in dispute, and these disputes were kept controlled by the Habsburg, by the Austro-Hungarian Empire, this, you know, multi-racial ethnic empire that collapsed, and all that maybe at the war ended in 1916. A lot of that turmoil could have been averted, and a lot of revolutions, whether it's in Russia or in Hungary or even Germany, could have been avoided. And to what extent do you blame the prolongation of the war, which is what the Balfour Declaration did? I don't want to. Maybe it's a bit reductionist, but it seems to me that the war is primarily prolonged to satisfy this desire to create, ultimately, to secure Palestine for the Jewish people, you know, which is Israel, you know.
Yeah, I'm not personally as familiar with that bit of history, but yeah. Certainly and definitely follow the reasoning.
But you're right about the diaspora. It's just, even if Israel didn't exist, in fact, if any way, Israel can be is an albatross because it's a lightning rod for criticism. It gets everyone's attention. It's something to criticize. Where obviously the diaspora by nature is dispersed. And how do you, although obviously there's organizations there, there were organizations that created Israel, Jewish organizations, specific organizations, both official and also unofficial, like you know, like the Jewish Mafia, that participated in the creation of Israel. So there was an organization there that, you know, that needed to be called out and criticized at the very least. If you're living in a liberal order and you're debating policies like foreign policy, what the relationship of the United States should be, you know, to Germany or to England, well, something like with in both the Wilson administrations of World War I and the Roosevelt administration of World War II, there was a heavy Jewish presence that was guiding U.S. policy into the war to achieve their interest. So at that, at least at that, in that particular instance, it's very important to be able to call out Jewish influence in government, to at the very least be able to openly debate these policies, you know.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, you know, if these people don't and aren't capable by their own admission of having the same kind of loyalty to these countries, then how can they be allowed to exercise an influence and a voice in these debates over foreign policies? Because just like you're saying, you can't trust them to be doing something that's actually in the interest of the nation.
Well, a good example would be like the American First Committee and Charles Lindbergh. He gives that speech in September 11, 1941, Des Moines, Iowa, where he calls out among the primary influences getting the United States into the war are Jews. That he's called an anti-Semite for that. But was he wrong? No, he was right. In fact, after the war, Rabbi Stephen Wise brags about the influence of Jews in getting America into the war and defeating Germany. So at the very least, Lindbergh was right when he described it. So American people should be presented with that fact that there's a heavy Jewish influencing, you know, lobbying the government to get their boys to go fight and die in the hundreds of thousands in on foreign lands. You know, American people should know that. Go to today, American policy of regarding Israel and the billions of dollars that were borrowing from Jewish bankers to give to Israel to prosecute this ethnic cleansing operation, we should be able to address the Jewish influence in our government. That would be like, should we consider the fact that America's relationship with Israel in the Middle East is affected by the fact that our Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, goes to the Middle East and says he identifies first as a Jew, but he's representing the United States. He's not going there as a Jew. And if he can't suppress that, then he should not be Secretary of State. The same way that we shouldn't have a Jewish Secretary of the Treasury who identifies first as a Jew, or Jewish senators, or Jewish anything in our government if they have this problem of identifying first as a Jew, because they're going to compromise the United States. They're going to get the United States to support policies that may not be in the interest of the United States, but the interest of Israel. You know, but you can't say that because it's anti-Semitic. Well, but it's a reality.
yeah, you know? And that's you know, they need to use that weapon of censorship, because otherwise, yeah, if it was presented to people, it would be eminently reasonable that obviously you don't want people to make decisions about the national direction if they themselves don't actually identify with the national interest. Like, you know, that's a completely reasonable thing. So
well, here's the thing with Chuck Schumer, senator from New York. He comes out and he says he's a Shomer. His name, Schumer, is Shomer, which is a guardian of Israel. And he brags about being a guardian of Israel. Well, that may work for his constituents in New York and New York City, and they can vote for him. But that's a problem for the rest of the country, because what he's saying now is he's a U.S. senator who sees himself as a guardian of Israel. At the same time, he's advocating open borders in the United States, not defending U.S. borders. But he thinks American blood and treasure should be expended on defending Israel's interests in the Middle East. You know, does that make me an anti-Semitic for acknowledging that? You know.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, or then whose interest are you supporting? You know, you see yourself first as a Jew, then you should not be in a U.S. senator, because you can't separate the two. You know, it's like, go to Israel, you know.
Yeah, and that's the thing, is that reasoning makes complete sense to a Gentile, and would make sense, I would guess, probably, you know, 99% of Americans. But from their perspective, like, you know, if you were to get to ask them the question, like, you know, the fact that you're a Jew and you primarily identify with the Jews and with Israel, like, how does that entitle you to make decisions for American foreign policy? And in their minds, like, yes, it does entitle them to make decisions for America, because America doesn't matter. And then whatever independent American interest we see existing, because it's our homeland and our country, they just don't recognize. It doesn't mean anything to them. It's not on the same level, because, you know, it's you know, you kind of run out of ways to say it. Like they just don't think that way. They're fundamentally different people. It's like I think I was watching a clip of Candace Owens before, shortly before she was kicked off the Daily Wire, and she was talking with this rabbi, and they're going back and forth about the situation in Palestine. And basically, he ends up saying, like, yes, you know, non-Jewish lives are actually worth less. And that's what these people believe. And they genuinely expect other people to eventually get in line with that. It's like we have nothing in common with them in terms of the principles that we hold that would make that idea abhorrent to us. Like they just don't share them at all. It's not something that comes naturally to them. It's not something they're really probably honestly like capable of understanding.
Yeah, evidently they don't have to either, because no one's gonna apparently gonna hold them accountable. I mean, just recently, the look at Israel. Okay, there's that World Kitchen operation. They're driving three vehicles on a designated safe passage road, and there's the vehicles are attacked three times. Apparently the outfit had told the IDF that they were using this and they would be on this road. Apparently, the IDF has used it as the information to assassinate all these aid workers. Now, the interest there is that Israel has said they don't want any independent aid workers in Palestine because they want to be able to control the food so they can starve everyone to death. So it's obvious this was a deliberate act. This is almost like just like the USS Liberty, three waves, whoops, whoops, and whoops. Come on, nothing's been done. And then I think the same weekend or within the day, they launch an attack. There's an Iranian, two Iranian generals at the Iranian consulate in Syria, Damascus. Israel launches openly, they admit to this, they launch a missile attack, demolishing the Iranian consulate in Damascus, Syria. Okay, so the Iranian consulate is sovereign territory. Syria supposedly is sovereign, but Israel thinks they can just launch missiles and kill, the people there, the generals, the staff who's ever there. So they attack two countries, and then the concern is the retaliation. It's just, well, why wouldn't you expect retaliation? And when the retaliation does come, it'll be like, oh my, they cry out as they strike you, as they say.
Yeah, like Iranian aggression.
Iranian aggression. It's like, what do you think? I mean, but they just get away with it, and there's no cutoff of aid. This should be a reason for cut off all aid, an embargo, sanctions and everything. But then again, to advocate sanctions against Israel, I think is effectively illegal in 30 US states. There's penalties involved in doing that, meaning you can't get state contract, you can be expelled from school, there's all types of restrictions. And none of this stuff passes constitutional muster. But what does it say that you have US representatives, governors are willing to propose these laws, sign these laws, even though it's a complete affront to the First Amendment, to our Constitution? But they know it. They know it's a violation, but they say it matters. Jewish feelings matter more than our Constitution,
Yeah.
which says it all right there.
And I think that what especially white Gentiles and whether Christian or not are going to have to learn is that there is nothing naturally constraining these people in this behavior. Like I think there's still maybe and a lot of it obviously is due to the level of control that the Jewish power is able to exercise throughout the West and to cultural narratives and stuff like that. But there is still just kind of like an incredulity, like a lack of understanding that there is genuinely nothing naturally reining in these people. Like it only stops when you put a stop to it, when you impose consequences, because the things that horrify us about all these actions just don't exist for them. It's not a part of their thinking. It's not something that ever occurs to them. Like to them, what's right is what they want to do. That's how they define right and wrong.
The one thing, bring it back to the book, as we're getting late in the interview, is this idea that whether it's the exploits or crimes of the Bolsheviks in Russia during the revolutionary period and after, or the crimes of Bela Kun, his regime in Hungary, in 4 months in Hungary in 1919, or the revolutionary activity that occurred in Bavaria, in Germany, and in Berlin with the Spartacists and all that. And is that the, this isn't so much ideological, it's just that you have Jews using the ideology as a pretext or justification to be Jews, to be revolutionary, to be subversive, to be violent, and to be hateful towards their gory hosts, their Gentile hosts. So it's not so much that Billy Kuhn was a communist, he was a Jew, a revolutionary Jew, same way that the Bolsheviks were, most of them were revolutionary Jews. And that's what matters more, which is what some people really remark about. That's the pattern you see, that whether it's in Germany or Hungary or Russia, you know, is their behavior, or Spain during the Civil War, is the fact that the violence is, and the hatred is animated not so much by an ideology, it's animated by their Jewish revolutionary spirit and their Jewish identity. And that's what makes it very difficult for people to today to talk in those terms, because to talk in those terms is to acknowledge that some of the criticisms that the fascists had towards Jews in the 1930s were accurate. And they were similar to some of the non-fascists, even Catholics and Christians would have towards Jews. But then all that changed after the narrative of the Second World War. And so now we are deprived the language that we need in order to combat it politically, or at least to describe the situation accurately, that there be some sort of maybe a political solution to this problem. But the liberal solution isn't going to work, because the electoral process that, you know, that are currently set up, the political rhetoric, the politicians, no one's going to address it in these terms, in terms that needs to be addressed. That's kind of I was kind of rambling there. I don't know if it made any sense.
Yeah, no, it does. It's like, I think again that if there were freedom to just speak about these things, then even the amount of lies and of propaganda and of cultural subversion that have taken place among Europeans and among white people would not really prove that much of an obstacle to the truth and to, you know, confronting this issue in a practical sense. It really is, you know, the maintenance of Jewish power in its physical ways and in material ways that enables this to continue. And you know, I think with you were saying the liberal solution doesn't work, and it's obviously true, and it's why, it's because it is going back to again what you were saying with the idea of Carl Schmitt and how his criticisms of democracy is, you know, the liberal Gentiles, and we can think of the term liberal here, it can extend it more broadly, not just like Democrats, but yeah, you know, generally speaking, the Gentiles of the post Enlightenment, you know, we have laws, we have principles, we have ideas, we do want Jews to live up to them, but when they don't, then what do you do? And the only solution when someone continues to flagrantly violate your principles is you need to have the necessary power and authority to stop them. So, you know, it's not like we're necessarily lacking the ideas or the tools to be able to recognize the issue, but we are lacking the political power necessary to make it effective and to kind of put any idea or any theory into practice, because until it's put into practice, it's dead effectively. It hasn't reached its true form. So, you know, to go back to what you were saying, a political solution is what's necessary, and that's where the solution will ultimately be found. And, you know, Gentiles just have to realize that until we assert ourselves in our own countries for our own interest and for our own principles, you know, there is no adult in the room.
Yeah, no adult, no sovereign. And again, in that fact, remember, power always exists. So if you're not exercising power, someone else is. So libertarianism isn't going to be your solution here. What I gather from the book is, I read about Hungary. I was familiar, generally familiar with Hungary and what occurred there in the 1919, 1920 period. I was always interested in the parallels that it shared with other countries that experienced Jewish influence. Governments or Jewish state, regimes, is that with what you can identify in history is that Jewish activism throughout the West follows very similar broad patterns, including an overrepresentation in like subversive things, abortion, sexual libertinism or sexual liberation, open borders, pro-immigration, diversity is our strength, diversity movements, all that, for to break down ethnic cohesion, to weaken the society, and also sort of cultural aggression and support of harmful causes to the interest of the host population, native population, just the general pattern. And so I saw in Hungary, the way the Jews behave in Hungary is a little different than the way the Jews behave in Germany and in Russia and maybe in the West today or United States today, because the circumstances are different, but there's a parallel here. It's always subversion. It's they don't believe and if they can, they will use force. But there was minorities, that's always a tough call for them. So in order for them to get into power, they need a completely destabilized political situation, like in Hungary 1919 or Russia 1917. In a more stabilized system, they need gradual subversion. That's where you get the authoritarian personality model, which, by the way, authoritarian personality was building upon Gregor Lukacs. And of course, authoritarian personality in 1950 supposedly said you need to undermine patriarchal male authority through sexual subversion, lest fascism arises. Basically, you need to morally corrupt the society, and otherwise you get fascism. That's basically what the authoritarian personality says. And that program is instituted or laid out or unfolds in the next 25, 30, 40, 50 years. Because of their control of the media and Hollywood and all that. And the liberal West is very open to that because the liberal West is open to anybody, supposedly, and won't exclude anybody. But when you get a group like the Jews, which are very nepotistic and very ethnically have a strong ethnic identity, they will organize to take over an industry which they took over and created Hollywood and they advertising and then with publishing and then with their financial power with their leverage their financial power to take over newspapers and media. So that's kind of a situation we face today. And but because we live in a liberal society, it's rude to point out Jewish dominance of the media or advertising or entertainment, even though that is, it's everyday real. It has profound impact on our culture. They brag about the impact it has on our culture. They brag about promoting sexual liberation and abortion and homosexual rights. But if you don't like those things, those are bad things, then in order to effectively counteract or reverse those trends, you have to identify and criticize Jewish power. But you can't do that because that's not allowed in our society because it's anti-Semitic. So, where are we now? But then again, we've anything else?
Nope, that's pretty much it. I think I got through a lot of what I thought were the really interesting parts of the book. So, again, it's a pretty short book and it's very interesting and it's written a lot like a story. It has a lot of information and it has a lot of insights that are packed into it. So definitely would like to recommend it for people. And other than that, thank you very much for having me on here. It's always great. And it was a great conversation.
Thank you for coming back on the show. Just get it. Just people should get the book at Antelope Hill.
Yep, antelopehillpublishing.com.
Okay. And again, go back to this. What if you were trying to describe what occurred in Hungary in 1919? You couldn't talk about Jews. It simply wouldn't make any sense, would it?
Yeah, I mean you'd have to basically say that aliens came and
And what if you were talking about America in 2024? Nothing seems to make sense, right?
yeah,
No,
you
why is that?
Sometimes people will say that it's all our fault and it's just like a suicidal tendency, but then, where did the suicidal tendency come from? I think that ultimately, in light of reality and what you can see and study, there's a much more compelling explanation.
Yes, and it's more compelling, and it's more actually. I guess it's more simple than you think, is it? So,
Yeah, I mean, it's so
yeah.
simple that they say it themselves publicly.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, well, thank you so much. That's Taylor Young and the Little Pill Publishing. I'll provide the links, and I'll bid you farewell. Good night, then. Thank you so much.
All right, thank you as well. Have a good night.
Take care. Bye-bye.